j'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de la queue, pète, pète, elle, deux ailes, le ventre, la dos, la cou, la tête.
Hello and welcome to the Nerd Kitchen. This is Max Da Vinci, and with me I have Ajit. In our previous episode, we were talking about fermentation. We went on this culinary journey throughout India as we touched upon fermentation and its application in dishes throughout in all corners of the country. We're continuing the conversation from where we left off. And if you recollect, we were talking about fermented foods and honey in Egypt. So as we've stepped out of the country, we thought we'll just continue that journey and go around the world to see what the richness of fermentation adds to dishes all over. Because as we've seen with foods, in there is this similarity in cuisines and of techniques, as we've seen with yeast, with fermentation now, with souring agents. You know, the similar concepts are used, but, you know, people use local ingredients. So we wanted to go and see what we can find. Some of the popular ones we're going to talk about are things you might have already heard of, like kimchi or sauerkraut. Kombucha is big with people nowadays. There is kefir for those of you who love the yogurt. And there is also a lot of these things, a lot of unknown fermented meats and things like that. So that's kind of the brief gist of what we're going to be traversing today. Let me bring in Ajit. Ajit.
Hi guys, great to have you with us. So as Max was talking about, kombucha, kefir, food items that rely quite heavily on fermentation for not only their formation, but also their nutritive benefits. And we kind of ventured into many parts inside India, but it turns out that, fermentation is actually kind of like a way of life throughout the world. There are a lot of cultures that resort to fermentation. Lot of them do it for food preservation. So there are these geographies with extreme climates, like Greenland and Scandinavia, where the weather is brutally cold for the most part, right? And also those regions are also known to be fairly meat-heavy regions. So the idea is to kind of hunt your game and then preserve it. And turns out fermentation is an elegantly simple way of doing that. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. And we're also going to talk about some fairly unusual things that are fermented, different types of meat. There's a lot of fermentation that revolves around fish and different type of milk products. So while we have a rich history of fermenting milk and, forming curd and yogurt, it turns out that there are all kinds of different types of milk that is historically being fermented across the world. So we're going to talk about some really exciting stuff. Now, as Max mentioned about kombucha, and since I happen to work on tea, kombucha is actually sometimes called mushroom tea or Manchurian mushroom, which is technically not true because it has nothing to do with fungal or mold fermentation. It is actually a lactobacillus/yeast-driven fermentation. So the mechanism is pretty similar to how you would kind of make kanji and stuff like that. It's essentially like a probiotic-driven fermentation kind of process, something that we talked about in the previous episode while addressing kanji as an example, right? There is, however, one very complex fermented food which is used nowadays very ubiquitously. It's called the soy sauce, right? So soy sauce is a really fascinating product. It's one of the rare products that uses two states of fermentation. The first is called koji, which is a solid state fermentation. So when you hear about fermentation, you typically associate fermentation with liquids, right? You lock apple with water and sugar, it makes apple cider vinegar. You lock in some vegetables in a brine or a liquid and it makes pickles. It's essentially a liquid-driven fermentation. So soy sauce is one of those rare food items which actually starts on the fundamental basis of solid-state fermentation. So the koji essentially refers to steamed soybean and wheat flour or roasted wheat that are brought in contact with each other in very sort of traditional containers. What happens as a result is you have fungus that actually drives the fermentation chemistry. This is a particular filamentous fungus that belongs to the Aspergillus family, and it releases certain enzymes that inherently is responsible for that amazing umami taste. So it's really interesting to see how, whether you choose to have a fungus or a mold to ferment in versus, you have this the next stage of fermentation, which is called moromi, where this koji fermented, fungus fermented soya bean is now stuck inside brine to drive different kind of fermentation chemistry, which is why soya sauce is a terrific example of something that is salty, but that also kind of defines umami. The principle behind which is the very mold-based fermentation that is released, that releases all these complex set of chemicals and free amino acids that makes it taste the way soya sauce does. And quite frankly, no other sauce in this world tastes like a soya sauce. So that kind of little interesting tidbit on soya sauce with the mold-based fermentation addition to your typical brine kind of fermentation, all wrapped in one nice bottle.
And on the same page as soy sauce, the fermented soybean and wheat, that is what is made into a paste, which then call as miso paste. And you use it in soups and noodles and all that. And similar concept, because it's a more of a paste, it's heartier, and it gives your soup so much body. But again, it is a byproduct of this whole fermentation process. And then when we're talking about soy, we also have tamari, which is it is thicker, it is less salty, but it is also it is a variant of the soy sauce family.
And I believe there is another condiment called mirin. I mean, now that we are kind of in Japan, which is also a sweet sort of a rice liquid seasoning that is used. I believe that is also fermented. And it's also used very commonly in dishes like teriyaki and ramen. So now that we are in Japan and kind of sticking to an Asia kind of a theme, I think it makes sense to talk about one of the most famous fermented foods that I think originated in Korea, right, Max?
Yep.
And that would be your kimchi, right? So, yes, go ahead, Max.
No, I was just going to say, for those of you who don't know, kimchi is just fermented vegetables. And there's a lot of varieties of that. One of the most popular ones is the one that is made with salted cabbages and spices. But then they also, have kimchi which has stuff which is made with radish, onions, garlic, and so on. And one of the easiest ways to use kimchi also, and I always tell this to people, is if you want to quickly resurrect any dish that you've made, any fried rice or anything that you, or noodles you've just got, any takeout that you've brought, and I do this, right? If you've got noodles or fried rice from someplace and it's tasting really bland and bad, spoonful of kimchi and you're good. Just mix in a spoonful of kimchi and it elevates the blandest and the tepidest of dishes to a completely different level.
So again, kimchi relies on the lacto fermentation kind of mechanism. So what you do is, you kind of rub it with a fair amount of salt, and of course you introduce chili, right? Now, it's really interesting to know that salting things has become a very common way of fermentation. And it takes us into a very interesting kind of a territory in terms of, using fermentation as a means to preserve food. What happens is, when you apply salt, how does it help with food preservation? Because I think we hear about pickles and all these salty food items that stay fresh for a long time. Or not fresh, but they stay edible for a long time. What salt does is it kind of attacks the bacteria by a very simple mechanism. It essentially dehydrates them. So it sucks out all the water out of their cells, rendering a lot of these bacteria ineffective. Of course, there are certain types of bacteria that are called halotolerant, which are actually resistant to these things. And they come into picture in certain other types of food items. So when you talk about fermenting food items with salt, simple example being, say, meat. So it turns out that a lot of the meat products that we consume, prosciutto, pancetta, salami, pepperoni, and these are some of the common things that we are used to. And later in the episode, we'll also talk about some unusually named dishes, which are also fermented. So what this does is it essentially hinders the spoilage-causing bacteria by just dehydrating them. And it then activates the lactic acid bacteria, which acidify the meat. So you're kind of curing the meat, and therefore it stays really, really stable at room temperature. And some of these meats are consumed raw. Some of them you still need to cook. So I think this acidification concept, I'd like to switch back to India. Because if we look at the famous kunde kebab of Lucknow, that particular meat is actually, it's not fermented, but the concept of acidification to tenderize the meat still remains true. So I think they use some papaya juice or something traditionally to acidify the meat, which softens it and gives it that characteristic, smoothness or whatever. So when you ferment things and acidify meat, so I think thinly sliced prosciutto is consumed raw as far as what I've read. Of course, certain other things like pancetta are typically not consumed raw because they come from a different part of body part of the animal, right? So the mechanism of preservation with salt is elegantly simple. It just dehydrates the harmful bacteria and then causes the lactic acid producing bacteria to activate. Now, if you look at some other cultures, particularly, you look at the Scandinavian countries and the those kind of geography. So I was reading up a little bit. In addition to meat, you also end up preserving a lot of different kinds of fish, because let's face it, when the temperature is really cold, stuff is frozen, so you can't even go fish and get some food for yourself. There is something called rakfisk, which is a Norwegian dish. It is essentially trout that is fermented, if you will, with a fair bit of salt. And after a few months or even years, it's actually eaten raw. You have something called surströmming. I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation. This is a Swedish delicacy with herring fish that is fermented with salt or preserved with salt. And this apparently has been going on since the 16th century. So these are all fairly old kind of things that are that have been in existence. I know it for a fact that in Greenland, there is this item called kivia. So this is really, really interesting piece of dish, right? It's fermented what are called auks, which are small ducks. And these little auks are fermented in seal skin. But the mechanism is same. Whatever the briny stuff or the salt that is present in these things, it just deactivates the harmful bacteria and keeps the food edible for a long, long time. So if you imagine the life of Inuit people in Greenland, they rely on things like kivia so that they have food to eat during those really, really harsh winters. And the mechanism is, again, just simple salt fermentation. But of course, this is the first time I came across an example where like these small duck-like creatures are fermented. And as a last example in this particular series of fermenting fish and having it as food, there is something called the lutefisk. It's a Norwegian Christmas feast delicacy. It's a white fish, which is not only salted, but apparently it's pickled in lye, which is kind of really strong sodium hydroxide, which gives it a particularly gelatinous texture. So it's really interesting that if you go down this road of fermenting, you kind of start discovering lots of cultures. So why certain food items are found in certain cultures, and at the heart of a lot of these things exists preservation of food, which is related to the weather. Therefore, you use fermentation as a means to preserve these things. So it's really fascinating that through these various seemingly disconnected facets of life, you discover these intriguing cultural elements across the world.
While you're at that region, another one I wanted to bring up was sauerkraut. And sauerkraut is like this less flavorful Western sibling of the kimchi, where where again, it is the lactobacillus which is at play, and salt is your primary, is what you're using for the fermentation. But then that's what they're doing. They're packing cabbages, shredded cabbage and salt, and then, you just keep packing it tighter and tighter, and slowly the cabbage starts losing water because of the salt, like Ajit mentioned. And then that it naturally, so you're not adding water as such, but it's the natural brine that's coming because cabbage is such a succulent vegetable. So you have this natural brine that comes in, and then that covers up the entire, all the cabbage. And now you keep packing it tighter and tighter, and then you seal it, and then that's left. Now, again, now, like Ajit said, it was done because of harsher weather and in colder conditions. So even for the miso, the kimchi that they spoke about, in the winter months, they would kind of dig holes and put these in there. So same thing where it goes for the sauerkraut is that they pack these into these jars, and then they would leave them for the cold months, so that then it ferments over a period of over that time. And then when you open it in, when you're having summer and you're having bratwurst and things like that, it's this natural condiment, and because it has so much salt in it. But you can see how these are so similarly related, where a sauerkraut from the Germany to kimchi versus some of these briny pickles that we make, we're more familiar in India, they all share a very similar pattern of whether of how they're packing and fermenting and processing these. But and you can see it's they're just called different names with slight modifications in process, but the core of it is all the same.
We talk about fermentation, and like I said, we get the majority of the things are driven by lacto-fermentation kind of processes. But what I have tried to do is kind of also read up a little bit on non-lactobacillus kind of fermentation. And I want to keep bringing that up because it just expands our horizon in terms of understanding what fermentation really is. A lot of the cheese that we consume actually, a lot of them derive their flavor from molds, right? Blue cheese being a classic example, or the Gorgonzola. And in many cases, the mold actually belongs to the penicillium family, which is obviously known for the therapeutic drug that was invented long, long ago. A lot of these things have these very, very peculiar enzymes, and the chemistry that comes into play is very complex, which is why you derive that very complex flavor in some of these things. And it turns out that the mold-fermented food items inherently have a very sharp, pungent taste to them. So you take a soy sauce, nothing else tastes like it. You take a blue cheese, no other cheese tastes like it. In spite of the fact that there is no liquid medium to really, facilitate transfer of either the bacterial activity or the flavor activity or anything. So I find this whole idea of non-lactobacillus fermented food items quite intriguing, and I hope to keep learning more, because I do think that every time we do an episode here, it's barely scratching the surface of an ocean of knowledge that's available to us.
So then talking about those, there's the other part of fermentation which we're pretty aware of, but we don't kind of think too much about it, is your yeast-based fermentation, especially in beverages like beer, where again, it's not salt, but it is the you are maximizing the contribution of the lactic acid producing bacteria, which is lactobacillus and pedicoccus, and in the brewing cycle, and that's what it gives you, gives that sourness to the beer. Now, again, not all beers are sour. Sour beers, there's this complete different genealogy of sour beers. The more popular beers are, are less sour, and maybe, and if you're in the IPA realm, then those are a lot more hoppy than anything else. But you have the same elements that are at play. And then when you, I know quite a few people who brew their own beer at home, and this is where it becomes really interesting, is because all you need for the beer fermentation is yeast and bacteria. But yeast and the bacteria is kind of everywhere. And what's in my kitchen is different from yours. And if you're not using proper yeast as a result of that, then it can latch onto any bacteria that's in your house, and then you end up getting really foul, really foully fermented beers. Not that anything's wrong with it, just that, it's the natural bacteria has taken over and overpowered the what's going to be in the yeast. So that's why the choice of yeast becomes important, or else you end up with really foul smelling moldy stuff. Another one where we bring in for fermentation is then in the wines section, right? And so you have this residual sugar, where which is residual sugar is what what grape sugars that are left over and after the fermentation ceases. So once the fermentation ceases, the juice of all these grapes, and then the fermentation uses up all the sugar as the yeast feasts upon it. And the byproduct of that is, you can have this bubbly carbon dioxide that gets released. The fermentation also kind of stops after a point. We're seeing all those things happen, and which is why I wanted to go back to the our previous episode, when we were talking about, you have these rice water that is left to ferment. If you go to, like, let's say the Far East, that's how sake and your rice wine come as well. So it's these very same things you see across regions, where they're using local ingredients to ferment and get what they want to get.
So now that we're talking about grains like rice and hop being fermented to get beer and stuff like that, there is one particular grain which is maize, and there is this particular dish called kanga pirau, which has been a staple of the Maori tribe in New Zealand. A couple of famous personalities from this tribe would include Taika Waititi and Jason Momoa. So the dish is best described as delicious corn porridge that smells like vomit, and yet it's a mainstay of the Maori cuisine. So what kanga pirau is, it's essentially the whole corn cob, which is, traditionally it's made by just immersing corn cob in bamboo baskets and letting them sit in a flowing river for weeks. Nowadays, obviously, it's not made that way, but the principle remains the same. You take a grain, which is corn or maize, you essentially just literally dip it in water, keep it submerged for a long time. And what this also does is it deprives the environment of oxygen. So a lot of these reactions happen under oxygen. So when you dip things for a long time under water, you are depriving it of oxygen. So that's a different chemistry for fermentation. And the end result is probably stuff that smells like vomit anyway. So the result, and of course you take the stuff and make a porridge out of it. So that is something I read up on kanga pirau, and I thought it would be kind of fun to share, because when we talk about fermenting grains, we usually limit our conversations to barley and rice, maybe even wheat, but I think corn or maize also deserves a special mention.
another region that uses fermentation in a way is the is when you have when you make the chipotle chilies and make your adobo mixture. Now that is also, again, you would generally not think of that is as fermentation, but the adobo mixture is fermented overnight, and that's what you get the that tang, because you're actually just, you just have these chilies in there, but because that is fermented, these chilies, you have the bite from the chili, but you also get that tang to the sauce. And this is something I did not know until recently, when one of my colleagues from Mexico, you know, mentioned about it, because I was kind of saying, yeah, adobo sauce, I like it. And then that's when she said, no, the real adobo sauce, you never had it. It's because it's fermented, and that goodness is unbeatable. And, you know, anything that you get store-bought wouldn't have that. So similar thing, you know, they use the chipotle chilies like you would. And, you know, they have garlic and shallots. I think they also have raisins and tomatoes in them. But it's this fermentation that, you know, gives it all of it. So what they do is they slice the jalapenos, remove the stems, the seeds, all of that, because that's the one that kind of goes bad. But so you, at the end, you only have the flesh. And then that is blended along with, you know, any of the garlics and shallots, cumin. They add, you know, all these spices that kind of go in there. But then that is then set, put in a bowl, and then they leave it in the attic, is what she told me. And then that slowly ferments.
So Max, things like adobo, if it's not entirely salt, then I would imagine some form of sugar has to kick in.
So yeah, I think they add sugar and so they add some sugar and vinegar. So maybe that's what aids the fermentation process.
Fermentation. It'll be fun to kind of read up a bit more on this.
And then moving to another region, like I'd mentioned at the start, you have you have kefir, which falls under the probiotic, which goes into this territory of probiotics, where it is, you know, it's actually drinkable, pourable yogurt at a very high level, but that's what they're doing. So it's not entirely yogurt, I think, because they're fermenting it many ways similar to yogurt and buttermilk, but what they also add is they add the kefir grains along with it. So yogurt, all you do is, you know, you heat the milk, you add the culture, and you keep it in a warm place. But then in kefir, you have kefir grains, and they are not actually real grains. They're called kefir grains, but they're actually tiny, rubbery looking cell structures that are actually home to the bacteria and yeast that helps to ferment the kefir. And it's kind of similar to SCOBY that is used in kombucha. Speaking of kombucha has become a big fad amongst people these days. It's a very similar concept to how I had mentioned with kefir, is that kombucha starts out as a sugary tea, right? And it's called SCOBY, but SCOBY is actually an acronym for symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And it's very close, similar to, let's say, like your vinegar. And this SCOBY is what, when you ferment your tea, the sugary tea in, after fermentation, when you kind of decant it, what you left is kombucha. And then we should probably bring our tea expert Ajit in here, because you may be able to shed more light into this than me.
Yeah, Max. So I think these days the knowledge on kombucha is fairly ubiquitous, because it again relies primarily on the lacto fermentation that you know, harnesses the power of bacteria and yeast, and it's structurally similar to a kanji or something, right? Now, working on tea, of course, if you thought that people are paying a lot of money to drink kombucha, There is something called pu'er tea. It's a very traditional beverage in China. But the thing about this is it's essentially like solid tea cakes. And these are passed on as legacy from one generation to another. So what ends up happening is you take the leaves, fresh tea leaves. These are very tender leaves. You kind of roll them gently. Then you roast them in a pan. And then you kind of, instead of drying them completely to kill all the enzymes, which is what makes your green tea and black tea, what you now do is you essentially compress them into a cake. And then you start burying them under earth and enable all kinds of fermentation to happen. And whenever you want to consume some tea, you just take a little piece of the cake, steep it in hot water, and then you consume the whole beverage. And these teas are typically rich in things like gallic acid and so on. And they taste very, very different than a typical chai. But if you want to truly talk about microbial fermentation and tea, pure tea is a very, very good kind of example. These are, like I said, bricks of chai. And it's really remarkable that, you know, these are passed down as heirlooms from one generation to another. So we are talking about shelf life of, I don't know, maybe a century or something. So it's really remarkable that when you don't control the fermentation, the food gets spoiled overnight. And if you get it right, it kind of, you know, stays okay for a century. So it's really remarkable how fermentation and the chemistry, the selective chemistry that revolves around fermentation really changes our life, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the worse, by either enabling us to store food or by destroying the food. So having some sort of understanding on fermentation really, really helps. And I can't emphasize enough on how any food-related conversation really takes us down this really fascinating wonderland of culture. And you keep discovering very unique facets of lots of cultures as you go down some of these paths. So Max, when you talked about kefir, which is milk-based fermentation, it's kind of interesting that, you know, this lactobacillus kind of bacterial and yeast-based fermentation, it's known to actually produce some amount of ethanol, and some of these drinks may end up having a bit of a kick to it, right? Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of other milk-based beverages that are consumed. One of them is called shubat. It is essentially camel's milk that is fermented, and it's fairly popular in Turkey. So I went to Turkey for one of the projects on chai. And I kind of heard about this particular thing, and I didn't get a chance to taste it, but I did hear about this, that shubat is consumed in some regions of Turkey. But I didn't pursue, because I kind of realized that some of these things may have ethanol, but it gets too cultural, I suppose. So I wasn't very keen on pursuing the conversation further. There is another beverage called kumis, which is of Mongolian origin, I think. And it's actually made from mare's milk. And there is also a variant that's available with donkey's milk. So the reason for choosing mare's milk over other animals is that apparently the sugar content is significantly higher. And therefore, it has a sourish taste, but also has that kick from alcohol. Because the more sugar you start with, the more alcohol is produced. So it's again, I mean, you can ferment literally anything and everything. I think we talked about meat, we talked about milk, we talked about soy, we talked about grains, we talked about fruits, we talked about vegetables. And you can make a whole host of food items using fermentation. But like I said, it's really fascinating to kind of go down this journey where you understand cultures and understand food habits and why certain regions function the way they do, it's a really fascinating interplay of various factors that define food habits for many, many regions. And I can safely say that fermentation is one of the key ways of consuming and preserving food. It's just that it's very important to get it right. So I'm really fascinated, because today we have the benefit of really sophisticated instruments, really sophisticated vessels and processing techniques. But I just wonder what people did, because like centuries ago, because some of these things are actually almost 400 years old. So without the benefit of, you know, Google or WhatsApp and all that stuff, how people got something as complex as fermentation right? So that is some food for thought, and I'll probably keep reading and learn a lot more about fermentation.
Just one last thing to add on that, as you're talking about milk, is that in Sikkim, Bhutan, and those kinds of areas, as you, when you mentioned camel, it struck me is that they use yak milk. Yak milk is a version of yak milk is fermented, and that is used. I don't recollect the name now, but you mentioning camel and mare brought that to my mind. If I find that out, I will tweet it out. But but you can see how they're using what is local, what is available to them. You know, the camel is what you have. Yeah. Yaks are what you know are more readily available for us, but. Let's see if we can do the same things here. On that note, I think we've covered a lot of fermentation around the world. I know, you know, it's simply not possible to be completely exhaustive, but to our memories, we've tried to, you know, point out a lot of these similarities in terms of process that people have been using across cultures and regions. If you do have any others, please don't hesitate. Drop us, you know, on Twitter at Nerd Kitchen Pod,
and maybe even give fermentation a try. I think most of the world is in lockdown, so might as well use this time to give fermentation a try. I'm pretty sure you have at least a couple of weeks in hand, so give it a shot. It's kind of fun to do.
Yeah, one of the easiest things to make is actually ginger ale. It's one of the most simple things. It's very difficult to go wrong with it. And then you could maybe graduate into the other things. But try ginger ale. I'm sure you know, you're not going out to buy any, at least. So trying ginger ale at home is probably one of the easiest and simplest things to do. For now, for this episode, this is Max Devinci and Ajit signing off. Thanks a lot, guys. Keep listening. Yep. And do share, like, and let spread the word about the podcast. Thank you so much. La tête.